Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review. This is Weekly Comics Spotlight 427 for comics originally released on October 14th, 2015. Now, starting us off in DC is Superman Lois and Clark number 1. This is written by Dan Jurgens and art by Lee Week. And this is spinning out of Convergence. And in kind of a very odd sense, it's also spinning out of the first story arc in Justice League, which is kind of interesting, but the problem I'm having with this is it's been a couple of months since Convergence, and I don't recall clearly, and I think they could have set it up a little better, exactly which Superman this is. I'm thinking it's the post-crisis one, but I'll admit I could be wrong on that because it's been just long enough since I've read the Convergence stuff, and there were so many Supermen to be had in that one.
Yeah, I remember Lee Weeks was involved in a couple of Convergence titles, and I don't remember if Superman was one of them, and maybe he was inspired by this, and that's why he's involved, or Jurgens and he together, maybe. Yeah, I couldn't remember exactly which one this is, or if I even read it. But they do give you a lot of backstory to kind of bring you up to speed, kind of.
Kind of. There are a few things that are left a little unsaid. They recap some of the stuff both from Convergence, from Crisis, and kind of, you know, time resetting itself and all of that. What I found fascinating with this was the decision to put this Superman, this Lois, and their son Jonathan on the main Earth in this multiverse, when they could have just as easily gone to some other world. You know, they could have been the only Superman and Lois in their world, but they're not. And I thought it was very intriguing for them to start with essentially recapping the Justice League fighting Darkseid in the first arc of Justice League, and that this Superman had kind of, at this point, I guess, always been there for that.
Yeah, just waiting for, if he was needed. If he had to come in, he was going to maybe come in. He was off to the side. It's kind of an interesting revisionist history, isn't it?
Well, yeah, exactly. They've retconned the New 52 world already. It's only been 4 or 5 years. And I'm not objecting to it. I just am curious why that decision was made versus, again, we've got a multiverse at DC. Let's use it. It was also unclear to me why he switched to the black costume. Again, it makes sense. It sets him apart from the other Superman. But there were a lot of things that kind of were left unsaid.
I mean, it leaves a lot more interesting storylines, I think, to interact with actual New 52 proper characters in the future, possibly. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they'll do that, but It leaves some more interesting opportunities and variables that isn't as interesting if it's on an Elseworld.
True, but it also implies he's been making a point of steering clear of all of those opportunities for years. And
but yeah, he won't even remodel his house.
Well, no,
I think it's ridiculous.
He does, just not at super speed. He does it slowly over time. Because if you look at the one page where she's, saying that, at the bottom of that page, they kind of do a panel break and it's years later and suddenly the house is fixed up. So they're just trying to stay undercover. And I get it. It makes sense. But you figure this is happening. What we're seeing is present day, but he's been around for the entire time of the New 52. Meaning some of this happened concurrently with, or actually I guess still afterwards, and no, concurrently with Huntress and Power Girl sneaking around. So it's there's a lot more Kryptonians and stuff on Earth than we had originally believed. The bottom line, though, is I like this Superman and this Lois. Their son Jonathan is interesting. We don't know much about him yet, but I think there's a lot of story potential there. I like how this Superman is trying to both stay undercover and explicitly make this world different than the one he came from, which again, to me, points to the post-crisis Superman is who this is. I'm curious where they go with it. I enjoyed it a lot. I thought it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, there was a clue there that I didn't quite capture with the ship, the spaceship that he went to interfere with, because when it crashed on his world, it created a supervillain. And yeah, I thought that would probably place him for somebody who had read that original story.
Well, in that, first off, I'm not going to say it was an original story, but in the story they are referencing, it was one that I'm pretty sure Dan Jurgens wrote, and this would have been in the 90s-ish or so. Basically, Superman is saving this world, this plane and or the spacecraft or whatever. Essentially, they do the Fantastic Four origin. So you've got four astronauts, which is why he's surprised here. There's only the one. And Hank Henshaw was essentially the Reed Richards.
Okay.
But they had three others. I forget exactly when and where they died. Might have been that story. It might have been later. But then Henshaw later became the cyborg Superman, which is kind of bizarre because we've already got a cyborg Superman that we saw in Supergirl, I think it was, a while back. So, yeah, I mean, they're definitely playing with continuity threads from the past, which is fun, but trying to keep it somewhat accessible. The last page kind of epilogue or teaser thing, okay, fine, they're setting something up. It didn't really do anything for me in and of itself, but, you know, they got to plant seeds so they can do stuff later. That's fine.
Yeah, that was just kind of very disjointed and so short that it hardly seemed necessary. I think there was enough on the page with just the characters and meeting the family, and the kid is interesting, and, you know, I like his spunk, and he's going to be fun down the road, I think. And that was enough, I think, to propel you into the next issue. That last page, I didn't think had anything in it really to even connect to what you've just read or compel you forward. I think you really didn't need it.
I agree. It makes more sense as an intro page to maybe another issue than as a teaser end of this one. The one complaint I think some people might have with this, and I think it's a legitimate complaint, is for number one, it expected you to go in knowing some stuff. And having gone in knowing that stuff, I was okay with that. But I can see where some people might object to, you know, okay, why wasn't there, you know, where was this Justice League story if they didn't read that stuff in the first six issues of that? You know, what's going on with the stuff that was the flashback to Convergence or whatever?
Well, I mean, I think, yeah, there's always going to be a little something like that that might get lost on folks or that might hang them up. But I didn't think it was problematic at all. And it's interesting. He seems like a fully powered Superman as well.
Yes.
Which is interesting. He's got all his powers and is not a practicing Superman. And then our Superman is depowered, but is actually the practicing Superman. So that's kind of cool.
He's still out going stuff, but it's funny because it puts this Superman, the Earth One post-crisis Superman, who I believe it is, I could be wrong though, in more or less the role that the Golden Age Superman was in for this Superman. A bit more of the elder statesman, the experienced, you know, kind of a guy. And I would love to see this Superman interacting with the main Superman or whatever, or some of these other characters. There's a lot of story potential here, and I hope this lasts long enough to realize that, and for them to, I hope they've got a game plan with this, that they're going to do some fun stuff with it and not just, yeah, he's a second Superman, what's the big deal kind of thing. You know what I mean? There are ways they could go wrong with this if they're not careful. But I have faith in Dan Jurgens.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was pretty engaging. Surprised me, you know, when I saw the title, I of course flashed back to the Dean Cain ABC television show from a long time ago, and so I thought, oh, what are they resurrecting here? And I was glad it wasn't that. And I think I get why they were calling it Lois and Clark, but I mean, there's probably a better name for it, I think. I like maybe Superman Family or something like that. That would have been a little more rooted in comic book past and not the television show. I liked a lot of the stuff, though. I mean, I liked the character. I liked the way that the different characters interacted. Seemed fun. I'm looking forward to them actually, like, meeting some proper New 52 characters in some kind of situation and what happens there. I don't know how long they'll wait to do that, if they'll ever do that. But I think there's a lot of stories to be told just in them existing the way they are. It could be fun.
Which character would you like them to meet the most?
Well, of course, I want him to meet Superman eventually, but I think any of the Justice League characters would be fun.
The one I think that would be the most fun right now is for this Superman to meet Bruce Wayne.
Well, he won't know him.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And this would give this Superman a chance to know a happy, well-adjusted Bruce Wayne. I think there's some fun potential there. But again, there's so many other characters. But I hope this also has its own identity and adventures beyond just that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. And I hope they get their A plot B plot thing down to where they can weave that in to where it's not just a throwaway page at the end.
Yeah,
you know, that would be my one real detriment to this, that I just thought that was kind of a waste, and probably need to rethink how you're going to tell that story or tell the next B plot or C plot that you want to introduce. I think there's better ways to do that. But all in all, I think they really did a good job with this, and I gave it a B plus.
Yeah, I went with a B plus also, and I think future issues should have better pacing because they don't have to spend as much time going over, you know, who he is, where he's from, you know, what happened in Justice League, what happened in Convergence, what happened in Crisis, all that kind of stuff. Giving him a little bit more time to do a good A plot, B plot, you know, what's going on with Clark, Lois, and Jonathan. And if they can get into that kind of a cadence, I think this could be a really good book.
And yeah, you know, and it didn't feel like it was chapter 1 of 5. It felt like it was just a first issue that was getting started, and it felt whole to me. And I love that. I love that when it doesn't feel like it's just 15-20% of a story.
Well, one of the things I'm hoping for with this title is we go back to kind of the post-crisis storytelling style there of following the life of. And if it feels like we're just getting continue, you know, the next day or week or whatever of what's going on with this family, and not, okay, 6-issue arc, clean break, start another arc an indeterminate amount later. But if it feels like we're just moving along forward with them on a continual basis.
That's what I want to, yeah.
Yeah, I'll be happy with that. And I think that's one of the things that works really well with The Walking Dead. And that's where I think a lot of comic books have kind of gone wrong in recent years, is they're telling individual stories with, again, too much of a clean break between them. But, you know, we'll see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Shall we move on to our Marvel book?
Yeah.
This is Sam Wilson Captain America, or Captain America Sam Wilson. Take your pick. If you read the cover or read the inside. I wish they would stay consistent on that sort of a thing. It's first issue. It's written by Nick Spencer. Daniel Acuna is doing the art. And this is the second first issue of a Captain America book for Falcon. So he's sticking around. That's good to see. This takes place in indeterminate amount of time after Secret Wars is overdone, undone, reverted, whatever. I liked a lot of this, but while it sets up Sam's status quo really well, I'm not crazy about the status quo. I'm curious to see where they go with it. There were aspects of this that felt very much like a DC book, which is odd for a Marvel book. Take the character out of their you know, position of power and respect or whatever. He's not a fugitive on the run, but he's clearly, you know, on the outs with the powers that be. And I don't know.
I thought it felt firmly rooted in the Hawkeyeization of recent comics, like Hawkeye, like Superior Foes, like Ant-Man, where they are very fallible. And this shows the more of the day-to-day stuff going on in their life than just the superheroic stuff. It felt pretty like that segment of Marvel that exists.
That's fair. I mean, Marvel's characters have always had the feet of clay aspect, and it is doing more the day-to-day. You're right, it is in line with like Hawkeye and stuff like that. But it also felt very much like the stuff we're getting in Superman, in Green Lantern, and things of that nature, where the characters are kind of on the outs with the law, but kind of, sort of. I mean, again, the talk of Cap's approval rating plummeting and, you know, things of that sort. Not that it's brand new and never been done in a Captain America book. It definitely has been. But it felt a little bit more of that sort of DC ilk for me than some of what you're referencing on the Marvel side. Flip side, I think it's better done than most DC books these days. But Nick Spencer, very talented writer, doing a good job.
Yeah, there's lots of fun stuff in here. I really liked the way, you know, he couldn't just rent the jet. Yeah, just go ahead and get the jet ready. Well, you can't really do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't have the same resources you had. You know, so struggling with overhead compartments and a shield and adamantium and stuff like that was fun. And flying coach. There's a lot of really good touches in here. I really like the partisan, you know, him declaring his partisanship a little and getting the blowback from that and not expecting it. I thought that was really well handled. There's a lot of really good stuff in here. I guess, but I like that type of storytelling. So it really appeals to my sensibilities.
Well, I like how they're differentiating this Cap from the Steve Rogers Cap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's an important thing to do. I also like how they're diving back into the Captain America mythos and stuff and bringing a few characters forward. Dennis here, Dennis Dunphy, D-Man, was one of Cap's sidekicks for a while back in either the 80s or the 90s. This is frankly, a much more competent version of the character. You know, the guy before was really not that bright. He'd been hit in the head a few too many times as a wrestler or whatever. But this guy seems like a really interesting, sidekick of sorts, if you will, for Cap or for Falcon, whichever.
And we saw a little Misty Knight in the Daredevil run,
mm-hmm.
and somewhere else, I think. She was somewhere else as well. So that was kind of cool to see her being used this way as well. I saw that Nick Spencer is defending his storytelling online on Twitter. Yeah, he's getting attacked for his characterizations of the Sons of the Serpent as basically conservative foils. I noticed a little bit of that blowing up on him recently.
So he didn't portray the villains in a good enough light?
I think the critic might have just been a soul guy, but he was going back and forth.
It was the internet. One guy can sound like a lot.
Exactly. And he was taking him to task because he was basically portraying them as, just conservatives and painting conservatives as almost Sons of the Serpent in his characterizations, which I didn't really get that. I didn't see that connection at all. So I'd have to read it again, I think.
I didn't take that out of it at all, but apparently somebody did. That's mm-hmm.
And this book does, it's Captain America, so there is some politics woven through, and this is the most politically I've seen it, you know, having these touch points along the way. So that's interesting, and it's a different way to go at it, but it makes sense for the character to me.
That would actually be a very interesting take for them to do with a future new Captain America, is have somebody that is very politically savvy and politically active as Captain America.
I think there's some definite places to go with this, and he touched on it a little bit, and be anxious to see if they continue down that road.
It came across as Sam really not thinking through and understanding the ramifications of what he was doing and saying, and not that he was wrong about any of it or whatever, but just he was, I think, a little too optimistic.
Yeah.
But if somebody were to... If they were to give him a political consultant, a PR person, you know what I mean, and reshape his character persona in the Marvel Universe or whatever, that could be a lot of fun. And having something that's got that political activism aspect to the character, again, would very much differentiate it from the Steve Rogers Captain America.
Yeah, there was something James Carville said about one of the candidates, probably Clinton, that he was managing, and he was going to come out during an Oscar race or something and say, you know, that he was really rooting for Braveheart. He really liked Braveheart. And he said, you can't do that. You can't even take that position because there is a giant swath of the country that didn't like Braveheart. So you cannot alienate those prospective voters. And that's how nuanced politics has to be. And it's ridiculous. And I love the fact that he doesn't have those handlers and he just says things from his heart, hopefully, and the repercussions fall.
Well, it's a matter of this Captain America having taking a position.
Yes.
Whereas the Steve Rogers Captain America had ideals.
Yes.
And it's, again, different characters, different approaches. I love that. I think it's a lot of fun. And I want to see that aspect of this kind of grow and them do some more with that. This was 24 story pages. We got an extra couple of pages, I felt. I liked that. Overall, I thought this was good. I did think in a couple of places there were a lot of captions, a lot of voiceover narration.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very wordy comic book, lot to read. And that's not a bad thing. And it didn't feel slow. It didn't really, you know, drag or anything like that. But I can see where the letterer would have been a little annoyed by having to do this book then, say, versus, you know, maybe one of the old Jeff Loeb Hulk books where it's rawr and that was about it for the dialogue.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, some of that stuff is exposition that you need for a first issue that you won't need going forward. Stuff about, you know, that the bird has a sonic cannon and things like that, you know, just or as a reminder for new readers, but probably won't need to happen going forward.
Some of it's that. Some of it is you need Falcon's voiceover to kind of explain, yeah, I did this and it didn't really work and some stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
To get sort of his side of things. So I think it was effectively done and I liked it, but it's also something that I could see some other people, it's just they don't want to do that much reading maybe.
Mm-hmm. I thought this first issue was a better first issue than the last Sam Wilson first issue. I liked it a lot more, found it a lot more accessible. Could have been my state of mind, but I liked it a lot better and really identify with this character more and find him way more interesting. And I was a solid B for me, and I'll be checking out the next issue.
No, I would agree with all of that. I thought this was a better first issue for Sam than the previous one. He starred in it versus, you know, I felt the other one had a bit more of Nomad, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, I think so.
Solid B. This was a good relaunch, but I don't think it was the strongest we've gotten for Marvel so far. I would currently probably say that was Iron Man, but I think we've had a couple others that were pretty good. One thing I do want to talk about a little before we move on, after this issue of story, the inside last page is something I've noticed in pretty much all the Marvel books right now. And it's basically, want to know what happens next? Get the next issue. Wow, what a concept. It never would have occurred to me to do that. A little flippant of me, of course, but I, on the one hand, appreciate that they're trying to sell that next issue. This is, I think, a much more effective way than just, hey, next issue, here's the cover, it's out in 4 weeks. You know, actually, hey, you want to know what happens next? Asking that question, don't miss that next issue. I'm curious if that's going to do anything for their reader retention or not. Gut feeling, probably not. Even so, I think it's a smart move to go do that sort of approach. Hopefully it works.
I mean, most books that have letter columns have this only much smaller, you know, usually a thumbnail of the next cover. So, yeah, this is a different way to go at it, I guess.
They're at least trying something.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying it line-wide, and I respect that.
And there probably will be times where it might continue in an Avengers book. You know, the next chapter of this story actually is over in New Avengers or something like that.
You're right. That's going to be a very good test of this sort of approach of does it really point you to the right place to go next? And if it's in another book, do they point you both to there and to the next issue here? What about when it annual ships? What about when it's change of a story arc or end of a series?
Yeah, that would be interesting to see how they do that.
Questions abound.
Mm-hmm.
Shall we move on to our other book?
Yeah.
This is Switch number 1 from Top Cow. Specifically, Stepan Sage, and I did check again this morning the correct pronunciation of that. Apparently, it's not Cedric like I had thought for the longest time. Stepan is the creator, he's doing the story, he's doing the art, he's doing pretty much everything on this. And this is essentially like an Ultimate Universe take on the Top Cow universe with all their artifacts, the Witchblade, the Darkness, all that kind of stuff. And have you read much of the Top Cow universe stuff?
I read a lot of Matt Hawkins, but not a lot of Witchblade.
Witchblade, Darkness, Artifacts. I'm trying to think which other ones have been in that universe.
Maybe a handful.
Okay. For a while, I was pretty deep into it. Ron Mars was doing some great stuff there. Then they essentially rebooted the universe, and I just didn't like what they rebooted it to. So I kind of got out there. So, I mean, I'm reading... the one that IX or whatever. I'm completely blanking on the name that they're publishing. Anyways, it's one set in the future. It's in the same universe.
Like Aphrodite 9.
Aphrodite, yes. That's the... They did an Apollo one. They've done a bunch of one-shots. Now I can't remember what the name of the main series is. Anyways, that's the one. So I'm familiar with a lot of these artifacts. I've read enough of this stuff, but I don't consider myself deep in that universe currently. And I thought they did a good job recapping kind of the nature of the Witchblade, its background, introducing us to the character, the high school girl that gets it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Batgirlization must be contagious. It's jumped from DC all the way over to Image.
Batgirlization or Ultimate?
Okay, yeah.
Because, I mean, you could take this back to Ultimate Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not replacing the Top Cow universe. This is just its own side thing. And it, for me, it wound up being a really fun kind of fresh take on the mythos. It's a little bit lighter in tone in some areas. And again, brilliant art. I again, big fan of Stepan Sage's art. And this thing is like 42 story pages. So we get plenty of time to get introduced to the main character, to get the crux of the conflict between the Darkness, Angelus, and all that stuff. How the Witchblade is caught in the middle. A lot of the major players, a lot of the minor players. I felt it went from, I can't say a blank slate because there was the baggage coming in from just the Top Cow universe, but I thought it was accessible enough that you aren't familiar with that. It's not a problem. And by the end of this, it's like, okay, I kind of get where they're going and what they're doing and stuff, and this is fun, and I'm enjoying it. How did it work for you?
Well, first of all, if you have a comic creator name pronunciation guide, I think you should patent that and distribute it to about every other comic podcast in the world, because they all need it.
I happened to catch an interview that they did on CBR TV, and Jonah made a point of, hey, you know, this is how their name is. Nobody gets it right. And he confirmed with them that he'd actually gotten it right, or at least close enough. So if Jonah says that's it and they agreed with him, who am I to argue?
That'll work. That's the first entry in the pronunciation guide. Copyright 2015.
Any creator, though, that's got a name that's not pronounced in an insanely obvious manner for those of us pronunciationally challenged, put like a phonetic guide or something. Jeez.
That would be fun. That would be fun to put together. I think that would be hilarious. But I thought it was better than the last couple of this universe that I've read. I liked it a little more, and I liked the young girl. I thought she was great. Her family was really good interaction. It felt fun. Was a little long. It felt a little long. So a lot of that stuff where they put in a lot of the kind of the supernatural elements and spend a little time there, that it kind of drug for me. But the stuff with her and the younger guy that had the artifact to begin with,
mm-hmm.
I thought those were fun, and yeah, it was just really kind of a fresh take on it, and it's kind of interesting. I didn't expect this from this book, and so I was happy. I hadn't read the solicitation or anything, so I was definitely pleasantly surprised.
I was expecting a little bit more, I don't want to say fan fiction kind of an approach, but something where it's like in this universe, those were toys, but they happened to work kind of a deal, or a little bit more tongue-in-cheek or something like that. Not as serious isn't the right word, but played straight kind of an approach. Again, an ultimatization or backerization of the Top Cow universe. You know, this is, again, parallel to the main one, so it's not replacing it, but doing it with younger, fresh characters with a a different approach to it or whatever. So it was a little different than I was expecting based on the solicits. But again, I'm very happy with this. I thought it was really good.
Now, is this going to be... he's not going to do this every month, is he?
I'm certainly expecting him to, yes. I think it's ongoing.
There's a lot of pages for the guy to do the art and the story.
I don't think he's doing this length every time. I think we essentially got the first two issues, or what might have been the first two issues, at a regular length. But Stepan is crazy prolific. How? I don't know. Because, again, he just finished up Death Vigil. He's got Ravine or whatever that's a trades that comes out periodically. Sunstone. And I'm thinking one or two other things. So how he gets everything done, beyond me, I'd love to know.
Yeah, and they're not, he doesn't take a lot of shortcuts. There's some really great detail in this art, and it seems very consistent throughout. I thought it was really solid.
Yeah, some of the stuff with her fighting at the end with the Una, the original Witchblade holder, you know, kind of ghosted in the background, was really well done. You know, there are places where the background's a little loose. There are other places where it's incredibly detailed. The rendering we get when we first see the Witchblade was beautifully done.
Well, there's a scene where the girl and her little brother are sitting around the kitchen table, and there's an old art project on the refrigerator, and it's just like the essence of the line drawing. You know, it's not a super detailed art piece, but you can tell that it was either that boy... A younger version of that boy who had drawn his sister.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it could have been the one next to it with the ladybug. There's a ladybug magnet on the one next to it, and it's just lines and squiggles. But the actual art piece, I know that that's a young kid who drew a picture of that girl. And that's, I thought that was just a little extra that you don't have to do. And nobody would have noticed or faulted you for not including something like that. It could have just been squiggles. And you would have been able to, but I thought that was cool. That's sort of little touches like that. I appreciate that as a reader.
Well, it's clear he takes an effort to try to flesh out the world, make it consistent, and feel real.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are places where, hey, there's a brick wall behind them, and you get the sense of the bricks and stuff. There are other places where the background is intentionally blurred out because it's not relevant to the action that's happening. It would get in the way of it.
Mm-hmm.
So making those decisions, and I think by and large always making them right, I liked a lot. You know, I've got a lot of faith in Stepan as an artist and as a writer. I think he's definitely proven his chops. And as somebody who was the artist on Witchblade for years, he knows the material. So him getting a chance to say, you know, here's a different look at it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a lot of fun, and I really commend Top Cow for, as near as I can tell, just giving him carte blanche, say, yep, these are our toys. Have fun with them. You know, that's a brave move for Top Cow to do.
My favorite parts of this were the pages with the girl, the main character, where it fell off for me as far as from an enjoyment was there's some stuff with this guy that looks kind of like Ponce de Leon. I can't remember his name, but he's got a big metal bowl hat on, and they kind of talk about more of the history and importance of what's going on, the bigger picture stuff, which I didn't find as interesting as I felt, you know, our grounded story with the main girl. And so that's kind of where I didn't enjoy it as much, but there's a lot here to hang your hat on because there's so many pages. There's a lot of good meaty story to enjoy. And although there seems to be two different stories going on, for folks that are fans of this world, they might not feel as disjointed as I did. I just downgraded a little bit. I still think it's a good comic, but it's a B minus.
All right. Interesting. For me, it was an A minus. I enjoyed those extra pages. I enjoyed having the world fleshed out, getting a sense of that bigger picture, getting beyond just meeting her and stuff like that. But it's also, you know, literally at least twice as much story as we would typically get in a first issue.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was a smart move for them to do, just because I think first issues need that additional space to flesh stuff out. I came out of this understanding what I think the book is. Now, whether I'm right or not, we'll find out in the future. But it made for, I think, a very strong first issue and one that I'm very, you know, excited to read more of.
Well, you know, for me, it feels like it's going to be kind of like Dr. Fate and some of these other reimaginings that we're seeing, where it's a just a younger, youthful version of what you may or may not know before. But I don't know as much about this world as you do, so you probably have an insight that I don't have.
I'm hoping we're going to branch out beyond this one girl and the Witchblade and get to see all the other 13 artifacts, see how this plays out, that kind of a thing. But I can also see where you're coming from of it's not the first time we've seen a new version of a character that's simply younger and different because just of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're about to go get that with the Totally Awesome Hulk and a few other characters and such. So I see where you're coming from. So I've read a lot of the number ones that came out this week and stuff from Marvel, read most of the stuff. It was a decent size week, actually. Trying to think what really jumped out at me as particularly good. I enjoyed Spider-Man 2099 number one. I thought that was good. Chewbacca number one was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I was surprised how good that was. I was really worried about that title and that maybe the Star Wars franchise had reached a little too far too soon. But I thought it was done really well and fun, and I look forward to seeing where that goes.
One of the things I liked about the Chewbacca stuff is he's one of those characters like Groot and a few others that, because of the way he speaks, it's a little hard to, you've got a couple of options on how to deal with it. Sometimes with Groot, you get Rocket Raccoon or somebody else essentially saying, yeah, I agree that blah, 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 which is essentially translating for him.
Mm-hmm.
Or you get the captions that flat out translate for him, or you just, you know, get the context or whatever. It was fun to have somebody hanging with Chewbacca that had no earthly idea what the hell he was saying for the most part.
Right.
So they were kind of, you know, in the same boat we were. New Avengers was good. Kind of the AIM Island becoming Avengers Island and such. Very different approach to a degree than what they've done recently in the Avengers, but also harkens back to an approach from, I'm thinking, the 80s or 90s, where, again, the Avengers had an island. Stingray was one of the guys running the base and stuff. They obviously didn't have this whole army of formerly evil scientists, but, you know, hey, we'll see where they go. What else was particularly good this week?
Walking Dead was particularly good.
Not surprising.
I thought The Fuse was really good. I really like the way that they construct their story arcs around a case, and they just it's fun, and I love this book.
It's very much a sci-fi book, no two ways about that, but it's also very much a police procedural book, more so than I think any other book I'm reading. Because I'd be hard-pressed to name any other comic, even though a lot of them are solving crimes and doing that kind of a thing, that have that centered around the case aspect that you're talking about, like The Fuse does.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that kind of surprises me, because these are crime fighters by and large. It would make sense for them to go with that kind of a shtick or that kind of a story technique. Got the final issue of Daymen. I thought that was good, but too many delays in the course of those 8 issues.
Wow. I had forgotten about that book entirely.
Yeah. Like I said, too many delays.
Batman was pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. As was, which are the other ones? It was the Batman Superman stuff was pretty good. Still liking Batman and Robin Eternal. Mm-hmm. Of course, 2 issues in, having a time to not like it.
I was fairly surprised by Twilight Children, the Gilbert Hernandez, Darwin Cook book. These are very well-respected creators, and I didn't get it. It was interesting. The art wasn't, you know, it's Darwin Cook, he's pretty talented, but the story was just kind of just a weird sci-fi tale that didn't really grab me. Hmm. And I expected a lot more, and it might be just my expectations were way too high for having these two creators together on a book. But it was just okay.
The expectations you go in with can make a huge difference on how much you do or don't like a book.
Yeah.
If you're expecting one thing and get something different, even if what you get is brilliant, but it's not what you were wanting or expecting at the time, that can be problematic. I didn't read that particular comic, so can't really speak to that.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad to see Vertigo putting out some new stuff, though, and consistently. just to see if something catches hold in the marketplace, and they can tell the stories that, you know, I used to love all the stuff Vertigo put out. So excited to see them at least trying to reinvigorate the line.
Well, to me, it's a matter of they've got to plant the flag. They mm-hmm. don't have a flagship title right now. And again, over the years, you could argue it was Hellblazer at one point. It was Swamp Thing. It was Fables. Sandman, Fables, you know, a Preacher. You know, there were a lot of things that either were definitely the flagship or at least in the running.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, they really don't have that.
No, it seems like they kind of squandered opportunities as the tentpole books they had were winding down to kind of find that next one. And
you could argue The Unwritten for a while was a contender. Beyond that, I'd be a little hard-pressed. I don't read all that much of Vertigo, to be honest. It tends to be a little bit more formerly in the supernatural vein for me, but now it's just a little kind of, I don't want to say all over the place, but I gravitate towards sci-fi, towards superheroes, you know, things of that ilk, and that's not what they tend to do. They tend to do really good stories.
Yeah, it's like an Image Light.
Almost. Yeah. Image Light or Image Dark, depending. But they haven't found their editorial vision and identity yet since they changed editors and such. And it's going to take them a little bit to really figure out what this phase of Vertigo really is. And that's fine. I mean, put some stuff out there, see what works, see what doesn't, see what the audience wants Vertigo to be these days. But then once you find that, seize it, own it, be it, and excel at it.
And I think they have an uphill battle because they are in competition with Image. These creators that have these stories, you know, unless they don't want to take on the financial risk, especially the celebrity creators with the name recognition, the superstar mm-hmm. creators, like a Darwin Cook. I'm surprised Darwin Cook and Gilbert Handes did not take this to Image. And I'd be anxious to see if they're rewarded for that decision or not.
Well, and that's the other thing. In addition to having a clear editorial vision and such, they got to have a good sales pitch. Why should somebody take a property there? As a reader, what should I expect out of a property there? Those two go hand in hand. And that's something that if they can manage that brand well, that would be very beneficial for them. But it's also a hard thing to do. And it's not that it's necessarily struggling right now. It's just not recoalesced after the changes.
And all these new Vertigo number ones, I mean, for all intents and purposes, to look at the solicits, they're just number ones. So they could be ongoings until they're not ongoings, correct?
Yeah, but I'm having a hard time these days defining what an ongoing is.
Oh, it's impossible. It's impossible for especially for most of the publishers to get a grasp on it, because even if it is an ongoing tentpole type of a franchise like Spider-Man, it still doesn't make it 12 issues.
But to me, an ongoing is almost one that as soon as it's canceled, it's reborn. It's kind of like a phoenix in that respect, I guess. Or it's got like a healing factor. It just comes back from the dead or what have you. So you've got those books. You know, this Captain America, ends. Okay, boom, another one comes in. You know, Amazing Spider-Man ends, another one. Maybe you're superior or whatever. But it's still the same, clearly the same thing. Then you've got that other sort of a title that it goes away. And there's clearly a replacement book, but it's also clearly not the same book. You know, like a Mighty Avengers Academy turning into Mighty Avengers or something of that sort, or mm-hmm. forget exactly how those transitions happen. You know what I mean?
Or a She-Hulk that comes and goes away, and maybe in another year or two it'll come back.
But to me, that's not ongoing. That's more sporadic.
Right, right.
You know, versus Wolverine goes away and Wolverines comes in. That goes away. The new Wolverine comes in. There's a rotation of titles. That's not exactly an ongoing, but it's not exactly not an ongoing.
Yeah.
The very concept of an ongoing title is, I think, in a bit of flux right now.
Now, Fantastic Four I would have put in that first camp, that there would always be probably be a Fantastic Four title, but doesn't seem to be the case.
Well, and I don't think anything is always in that category. Thor at one point wasn't published for a few years. But there was a journey into mystery. Does that count? Does it not? It's got somebody else, whatever. You know, at one point it looked like you couldn't, you know, turn around without bumping into three new Punisher titles. That kind of went away for a while, you know? So those things change as the market changes, or as time changes and the audience changes.
There'll always be a Batman, a Justice League. Will all the individual members of the Justice League always have a book, though? They can probably come and go, right?
I would say all the core members.
There will always be a Wonder Woman?
Yes.
Okay.
Wonder Woman will go no less than quarterly. I guarantee it. And you're asking, how can he make that guarantee? If you go back to around the time of Crisis on Infinite Earths, DC published Legends of Wonder Woman, or The Legend of Wonder Woman, I forget what it was. And it was a very cartoony book, very much out of the style of what they were normally doing for Wonder Woman. But it's basically a matter of, with the estate that they've licensed the character from, if they don't publish X amount per year, and I think it's one a quarter, but I could be wrong on that, because the agreement dates back ages, they lose the rights.
Wow, I'd love to know, wonder how many of those characters are like that.
I don't think there's all that many, but I don't know what agreement they made with the Siegel Schuster, you know, estates, that sort of a deal. So it's possible it applies to other characters. But
Bob Kane, maybe?
Maybe, but I doubt it. I think some of these they more or less own free and clear. But I would be surprised if we ever hit a point where the majority of the core Justice League are Superman, Wonder Woman, Batman, Flash, Green Lantern, if they don't have a book. But you could argue that's the definition of a core Justice Leaguer, too. You know, the peripheral ones, the satellite era ones, those are the ones that have books that come and go. Green Arrow, Hawkman, Firestorm.
Well, I mean, DC's doing a much better job of consistency and ongoing than Marvel is. I mean, they've at least got issues in the 40s, a significant number of issues in the 40s.
Well, they keep volumes going longer, but then when they get rid of a volume, the characters just vanish. Hawk and Dove, have we seen them since their book ended? I don't think so. Maybe once or twice, but you know, it's like, poof, they're gone. Whereas Marvel, their volumes last, in some cases, really short, maybe 5 issues, but the characters keep coming back. So it's just different approaches. And I don't know that I would say DC's better at it. I think they've had more property rotation, even though their titles last longer.
Mm-hmm.
And Marvel's title volumes last shorter, but stick around.
Yeah, I think the new volume of Squirrel Girl is has a thing on the cover. Only our second number one this year.
Yeah.
It says, what a claim to fame that is.
That's annoying to me on a deep and spiritual level. And if you start noticing even more kind of, you know, weird things in my numbers in the next few months, that's going to be a lot of it.
That's going to be the reason why, yeah.
Just tracking, you know, is this really a first issue? Is it really reorder activity? Particularly ones that relaunch. I've got to figure out how I refer to that in my numbers. Is that going to be, you know, Unbeatable Squirrel Girl 2015 B number one? Or what?
Yeah.
Most people don't care about this, and I get it, but I think it makes it hard to find back issues and stuff like this. And it when the titles or the volumes end like that, it kills interest in the back issues.
Well, yeah. I mean, I missed the second issue of Ant-Man. From 2015. I need to go to the store and get it. Wait, which number two is that? They both look very similar. Which volume is that? I can't tell.
Are they the same book or are they just different covers?
Could it be a variant cover? Exactly.
It's surprisingly confusing. And anyone who doesn't believe that, go to a comic book store. Ask them, can I see the first issue of Captain America? Well, one, which Captain America, which first issue, which volume, you know, it's crazy, stupid crazy. And it's a problem that's just going to get worse over time. You know, the ship has sailed, sunk, and we're going to deal with the wreckage forever. You know, when I was reading comics, it was, this is Captain America, boom, that's the title.
Yeah.
You know,
it's issue 272. Get over it, hop on, you'll figure it out.
Well, and people would get on with any issue number. That went away with the story arcs. It's like, well, I better wait for part one of whatever. Okay. Then it got to where it's like, no, I'm just waiting for a number one, not even a part one. Now I think it's going to get to the point where there's so many of these new number ones, if they're going to wait till it's a brand new property.
Well, we experimented with the point one as the signal to jump on the Pavlovian symbol that now it's safe to jump in,
which I thought was a huge mistake.
Yeah. And then they scrapped that and then went to, well, let's just launch them as a new number one every 6 months. That'll solve that.
So if you don't like it, you're going to basically not try that property again.
You know, that's where I'm at. I mean, I kind of committed to myself that I would try all the new number ones. But I'm looking at some of these that I had already kind of passed on the previous volume. You know, 2099. I don't know if I really want to try that first issue again. I'm not sure how much different. It's the same creator. What's really changed, you know? And do I even need to bother? And that's what I'm kind of mulling over is why am I bothering with these number ones? They're artificial number ones.
And that's part of the problem. And it would be interesting to come up with some kind of a metric of, I don't say average title longevity or whatever, but if somebody were to be reading at point X, at what point is 80% or more of the books they could have been reading are over, you know? And I think there are certain times that are worse than others and stuff, but it's a habitual reading habit that if you relaunch the title, rename the title, drastic change in direction, major shift in creative team and stuff, you can throw people off a book as readers. And that's obviously bad for business.
Yeah, there are these accepted idioms in comics that I'm not sure if they're true or if they've been proven out over time or not, but, you know, that mini series do not sell, that, you know, people want number ones. You know, there's these things that are thrown out there as fact. And I don't know if that's necessarily true or that's just the way the circumstances were for that particular set of books.
Well, I think part of it is there are too many variables to really narrow some of it down.
Yeah.
I mean, the charts I've looked at very much indicate that, yeah, number ones sell better, but just more or less the number ones by three issues in, you're back to how the title had been selling. So it's not like a new number one really in reinvigorates sales, but the new number ones are selling better because they put 1,000 covers on them and such. They put a big promotional push. So it's not even that people want the new number ones. It's that that's what they're getting advertised. You know, if you're promoting that, that's what's going to have some interest. But I don't see any publisher really experimenting with trying to prove or disprove any of those theories.
Yeah, and I wonder, like, if Dark Knight 3, would that have sold more or less if that was pitched as an ongoing versus pitched as, was it 8-issue miniseries?
It would do less. That's something that really you're going to do an ongoing out of this. I think we're a jaded and cynical bunch. To me, they do need to be much more upfront, though, about are some of these things, you know, limited series or not. You know, to be claiming Green Lantern, the Lost Army, oh, it was meant to be 6 issues. Really? Why didn't you say so?
Well, I think Dark Knight 3 has kind of an uphill battle just because Sandman Overture came before it and just couldn't keep to a schedule and was underwhelming and expectations were high. So I wonder if that was recent enough history. I think 6, the special edition of 6 still hasn't come out yet. So
correct.
It's recent enough that I think there's going to be a significant portion of folks that might have been interested in that less so and more tentative. Like me, who's going to wait for the trade?
Yeah, I can understand that. There were delays on Dark Knight 2, weren't there?
I've set that one out, so yeah, I don't know that.
Yeah, we'll see. I think they just need to be a little more upfront on some of that, and obviously for some of those event titles, plan out the schedule a bit better.
But yeah, I mean, I understand when they do it. You know, you can point to those first 3 issues of a new volume, and that's money. That's just free money. It's just free money for them, and they grab it.
I question how free it is based on how many covers they sometimes have to do. And it comes down to not knowing the cover rates on certain artists to determine some of that.
True. I guess to get a real, yeah, you'd have to do something without variant covers to be able to compare apples to apples, wouldn't you?
Yeah. And that's the thing, is there are no apples to apples. If they had taken a couple of the Marvel books and not renumbered them to a number one, okay, that would be a benchmark. But only if they did the same number of variant covers or lack thereof, the same promotional push, that kind of a deal. You know, there's a lot of things people are drawing conclusions from, but it's hard to really say categorically that's the cause. New number ones sell better. It's like, oh, but you're discounting the promotional push. You're discounting, you know, this, that, and the other.
Yeah, if there's 27 variant covers and you had to pay $1,000 a cover, and, you know, that only increased your sales by 20,000 issues, was it really worth it?
Well, does it sell better and is it more profitable? And I never get into the is it more profitable discussion because I don't have the data. But It's something that I'd like to see them focus on, just telling better stories. I think that's...
Does it sell better to the comic shop?
Oh, yeah, but telling better stories will sell better.
Yeah.
Because if you've got readers that are more hooked and that you don't have to say, hey, we're going to do a second issue, you might want to check it out. If they're just clamoring for the second issue, that's where you want to be. So, anything else? Does that do it?
Oh, I did want to... Yeah. I think this comes out, a week before the previews comes out?
Oh, good call. Good call. It'll... this will go up on the 26th. Previews should be out the 28th. Mm-hmm. The deadline will be November 7th. We had a great turnout this last time.
I just listened to that. There were 55 clips. And I don't know if you did as many as you normally did. It seems like you held yourself back a little bit.
I may have been down maybe one or something. I may have done 8 versus 9.
Okay.
Normally what I try to do is... pick one from each of the five major premier publishers and then like four from the back. I say that's what I try to do. I've looked through the Dark Horse solicits for this coming round and I didn't really find anything. So maybe I'll do something else. You know, I try to have around 9 or so, but I try to find good jumping on points, things I think people will like and stuff. And some months it's really easy to find stuff and hard to whittle it down. Other months, it's not so easy.
Yeah, the Venn diagram of new titles with good jumping on points and things that you like, sometimes it's tough to find for certain publishers.
There may be a lot of stuff I like, but they're all in the middle of an arc or just ending an arc or something like that. Yeah, it can be tough.
Yeah, it's definitely tough. But it was really cool episode. I thought there was some great clips and some fun stuff that was sent in. So I hope folks continue to do that. And share that with folks that are comic-minded as well, because we love to have new voices on that. I love to hear new voices and different things that people can just get their feet wet with one clip, and then it's like the drug dealer on the corner. You come back and you want more.
Well, and if you're enjoying these episodes, you know, click like on Facebook, on do a review on iTunes, and share the episodes. Because, again, we're here to share the love of comics. We want other people to enjoy it, find stuff they're interested in. And if they can then feed in clips to the preview spotlight and stuff like that about what they enjoy and stuff, that's it's a win-win for everybody.
Yeah, yeah. It was a really good episode. Good stuff.
No, I was just blown away by the number of clips. I was very pleased with that. Hopefully we'll have that again.
Yeah.
So anything else, or does that do it?
That'll do it. That'll do it.
Cool.
Join us next time as we discuss Titans Hunt number 1 from DC, Karnak number 1 from Marvel, and Back to the Future number 1 from IDW.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.